on Drive Time with Middle East Eye. Middle East
Eye. And welcome to Drive Time, and welcome to our penultimate in this series, our Middle East report in partnership with the London-based Middle East Eye. 3ws.middleeasteye.net gets you there. At Middle East Eye is the Twitter handle. In this week, we have a look at the proposed annexation of parts of the West Bank, or the whole West Bank, or the Jordan Valley, what's in Netanyahu's head. Egypt President Sisi threats to invade Libya if Sirte falls to the GNA, and what John Bolton is talking about in his book about Trump. Online is Editor-in-Chief of the London-based Middle East Eye, David Hurst. David, welcome.
Hello, Shafi.
Let's have a look. Interesting stuff about this whole annexation story. We see United Nations Antonio Guterres saying it's a watershed moment, a serious violation of international law, but curiously still talking about a two-state solution. Yeah, it's a bit of a contradiction going there in a sense.
Well, yes, I mean, one aspect of the annexation plan, which is, and the reason people are talking about now is because July the 1st, mentioned in the coalition agreement between Netanyahu and Gantz, which was the agreement that led to the formation of the government. And so it's very, very much a date. But we don't at the moment know what is going to be proposed and what America will allow. In fact, there's been, Haaretz has reported yesterday, there have been 2 days of meetings in the White House just to hammer this out. If any form of annexation went ahead, it really would destroy the two-state solution, or at least the myth or mirage of a negotiated settlement, which involved the creation of some form of Palestinian state, contiguous or not. Because what would happen under this annexation is that Israel would move its boundaries eastwards, and it would not be offering citizenship or residency to the Palestinians under its control. So it would move officially towards being an apartheid state, not just being accused of it, but actually officially adopting that label. And it would similarly ditch the idea of a Jewish and democratic state, which has been the basis of support for Israel since it was created. I mean, people are divided about what is actually going to happen, not only the maximalist or minimalist approach, but whether it actually makes any difference, because they say, well, Israel, for instance, if it's just three settlement blocks east of Jerusalem, that is Israeli territory anyway, de facto. This would be a change from de facto, to excuse my Latin, de jure, mm-hmm. i.e. from a de facto sense to an actual legal sense. But it still would have massive implications, because one thing that would happen is that any Palestinian owning land in that space would be regarded as an absentee landlord, an absentee owner, and then land would be subject to appropriation by the Israeli state. So I think we'd have enormous, whatever's decided, whatever's going to happen, it would have enormous implications. This is the biggest thing in terms of a land grab since 1967.
It certainly is. The Arab League in your story saying quite mildly that it could trigger a major confrontation. The Palestinian foreign minister saying Israel is testing the resolve of the international community. Do you think people realize enough the enormity of what we could be? We don't know whether we're going to witness it, but what we could be witnessing.
Not yet, and I think in the light of all announcements by Trump it's going to be chaotic. We had Saeb Erekat, the veteran Palestinian negotiator, speaking today in Middle East Eye, saying stop treating Israel as a state above the law and an annexation. And what really, he was really aiming his comments at the EU. I think Netanyahu and the sort of the messianic wing, if I put it that way, of the Trump administration, his son-in-law, but also Adelson, the billionaire Republican donor, all of those people who are almost more Catholic than the Pope, they are more pro-settler than almost the settlers are themselves, including David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel. They all think that now is the time to strike, that there is no better time. You're never going to get a political force or a White House which is more pro-Israeli and more pro-settler than the one that's there at the moment. So do it now. The Palestinians are at their weakest. And they also calculate that the EU will do nothing. This is what Saeb Erekat is arguing for. Is if you let Israel get away with this and you don't impose sanctions on it, if you just condemn it with words, but you will not compose the... put sanctions on the Israeli state for doing this, which is completely illegal under international law, then they will do it. And so he's aiming his fire at the European governments, particularly Germany, who has not supported the PLO's or the PA's reference of Israel for war crimes in Gaza to the International Criminal Court. It condemns what Israel does, but doesn't actually do anything about it. If that's the case, and that continues to be the case, then Netanyahu and Israel and Friedman and all the rest of them who are pushing for this are right in their calculations that nothing really will happen. Again, the another set of their calculations is that the Arab states will do nothing because they think they've fundamentally got Saudi Arabia, UAE, everyone on their side. I think that's a very big miscalculation. And I think when Jordan says this is an existential threat to Jordan and you're messing with the stability of not only an Arab state that recognizes you, one of two, but with your longest land border, then that is a real threat. And there are signs that the PA is coordinating with King Abdullah II in Jordan, and I think that is causing the White House to think long and hard about annexation. So we could get an announcement of an intent on in or around July the 1st, and then a very gradual approach, or we could get a minimalist approach. I think any version of this plan is dangerous.
No, absolutely. And of course, I mean, you mentioned that there have been meetings going on at Capitol Hill, but Pompeo, you know, from the last statements that I saw him making, was he was kind of saying, okay, guys, the ball is in your court, and being deliberately vague, which doesn't really help the situation south, west, or north.
Yeah, we'll get onto this in the last. This is very, very much a characteristic of the White House run by Trump. Everyone says whatever they want and then walks back from it. So it's a complete cacophony of voices. Kushner is slightly more, obviously he is 150% behind this plan and very much the author of it. But he, in recent weeks, has been, quoted as saying that he is, or reported as putting a bit of a break up to these plans and trying to hold Netanyahu back a little bit because he's frightened about what Jordan will happen. I mean, I think there are two things that will really, if they do announce annexation, either the Jordan Valley or the settlement blocks or an intent to do that. The first is that I think, there'll be a real reaction in the West Bank at some point. And I don't think there'll be a break on that action. I think it is pushing the Palestinian factions together. And also, there'll be a big reaction from Jordan as well. And both see this as a real existential threat. I mean, Israelis think that with facts on the ground, they can simply get away with it. They're stronger than ever before, and the Palestinians are weaker than ever before. But that calculation has been made time and again. It also would be the first time. I mean, there's another serious point to be made about this. Previous annexations, Israel could argue, well, you know, they were defeated in the 48. There was a war involving Arab armies. Again, in 67, there was a war involving Arab armies. They were defeated. Therefore, the Palestinians lost land. There's no war going on this time. Mm-hmm. This is a completely unilateral, complete war of choice. It will fundamentally change the map. When things like this happen, it takes decades to adjust to the new reality. And this is a recipe, at the very least, for decades more of conflict.
Absolutely. And talking about conflict in Libya, General Abdel Fattah Sisi, the Egyptian leader, is very unhappy and edgy about GNA gains. Haftar has been sort of in retreat of the LNA. And, of course, this is sort of pushing Turkey and Egypt center stage. It looks like the proxy war is over, in a sense.
Well, this is quite an interesting statement. It was a statement I think he made on Sunday in which he said he called for the army to be ready to move into Libya. The Turks are very sanguine about this statement because, as everyone knows, the Egyptian army already is in Libya and has been supplying Haftar with heavy weaponry and planes and all sorts of kit and also troops for a long time. In fact, Turkey has been one of the backbones of Haftar. I think Sisi is under quite a lot of pressure. Firstly, Haftar has suffered a series of big defeats, and he's been pushed right away out of Western Libya back to Sirte. The Russians have piled in warplanes there to say that Sirte is a red line. And the current negotiating situation of the GNA in the Government of National Accord in Tripoli is to say they will only talk about a ceasefire if Haftar's forces leave Sirte. So they think they're in a position now to make demands. I don't think they're beyond criticism themselves. I think one thing that should have happened is that Tripoli should have kept the door open to Egypt, because there are signs that Egypt was fed up with supporting Haftar, as well as frustration that Putin, between Putin and Haftar, and that maybe a little bit more effort should have been made to not accommodate Haftar, because you can't really, he's always walked away from the negotiating table, but certainly accommodate other people, for instance, his head of parliament in Tobruk, because again, the only way this is going to end is with a ceasefire and then some form of government, of national accord and agreement. So no side is actually going to win. And I certainly don't think that Tripoli imagines that its forces are going to march into Benghazi or Tobruk. But what could happen is at least a ceasefire and some form of the beginnings of a negotiated agreement with an awful lot of devolution between East and West and some division of the spoils. But up to now, Haftar has not been in the market for negotiations. He's walked out of several negotiations. But that's the Libya side of things. In the Egyptian side of things, other people have said that the reason why Sisi made a statement on Libya was because he's in so much trouble anyway with the Ethiopia, the Renaissance Dam in Ethiopia, just about to start filling up. And that will have a massive effect on the water levels of the Nile, particularly the upper Nile. And this is a disaster waiting to happen. And also coronavirus. So he's basically seeking to do the typical thing that military dictators do, launch a war to distract from very, very big domestic problems. I think the Turkish forces are much more sanguine than that. They know what they can do. Turkey will continue to be a de facto military power in Libya, as probably will all the other people, like the Libyans, like the Russians, who still have 3,000 troops in insert mercenaries, and the Egyptians. So I think a negotiated settlement between Turkey, Russia, and Egypt is possibly the best outcome. But for the moment, there are all sorts of bellicose statements being made.
Absolutely, and to get to the final item, Bolton's book. Your feelings to me, it's, it almost seems like it's a book written out of bitterness that Trump fired him. And he's decided he's going to try and hang out some dirty washing, and dirty washing it seems to be. I mean, what do you make of it?
Well, I don't know who comes out worse, Trump or Bolton. Bolton's an enormously conceited character who relishes in tearing apart international treaties like the ABM Treaty, or he relishes describing how he was trying to persuade Trump to bomb North Korea to get rid of their missile silos. He relishes his part. In fact, he describes it as his plan in dismantling the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement with Iran that so many countries under former American presidents spent so long constructing. He said we got rid of it in a month. But you really don't know who's worse, Trump or Bolton. I think what Bolton, yes, I agree, he's an enormously bitter character who thinks he's been right on every single issue. He was discarded by Trump. I think a lot of the book is true, true in the sense that the central revelation is that, forget Ukraine, Donald Trump tried to enlist Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, for his re-election bid, and he was trying to get China to buy wheat from American states that farmers that were going to vote for Trump. So he was using China as a sort of re-election tool, not just Ukraine. That's the sort of central allegation in the book. That should come as absolutely no surprise to anyone who has read the Mueller report into Russian efforts to interfere with the 2016 campaign, or Trump's impeachment, or the Ukraine inquiry. That's been a very, very strong leitmotif of the Trump White Warehouse. There is no foreign leader too big or too important who shouldn't be enlisted in Trump's own vote-gathering campaign. That's what he really cares about. And foreign policy is subordinate to his massive ego. I mean, Bolton's right. He is totally unsuited to becoming U.S. president. But Obama reached the same conclusion a long time ago. I think collectively, America is in a huge, huge mess, which will take a long, long time to recover from, if it ever does, because after Trump, people and the American drawdown, people like China or like Putin simply do not take America as seriously as they once did. And it's been a massive exercise in shooting themselves in the foot every single time Trump opens his mouth. Trump exceptionalism, American exceptionalism now is reduced not to Trump, not to America being great, but to being but for America to have a second wave of a coronavirus, and particularly in the states that in the South and the red America that voted for Trump. So Trump's in an awful lot of trouble. And the Bolton book is basically more evidence for it. But Bolton himself is a deeply unpleasant, warmongering conservative man who's already done untold damage to America as a reliable international partner.
Yeah, and you've probably been kind to John Bolton at the end of it. But David Hurst, Editor-in-Chief of the London-based Middle East Eye, that brings to a close the special series of programs that we did together. David, it's been an absolute pleasure working with you, a pleasure working with Middle East Eye, and of course we will be carrying on working behind the scenes. But thank you for your cooperation.
Not at all. It's been my pleasure, and I wish you, your radio station, and your audience all the best.
And of course, the Middle East Eye, www.middleeasteye.net. That's where you can get them. Twitter handle @MiddleEastEye. David Hurst, thanks a lot. Been a pleasure.